Sam Brunson is a law professor at Loyola University of Chicago. He's a tax expert and an active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We reached out to Brunson this week to talk about whether churches should be tax exempt. It's hard to pin down the exact numbers, but most agree Brunson's own church has billions of dollars in wealth, in stocks and securities and real estate and businesses, a portfolio estimated to be near $250 billion. And the questions come up all the time. Do they really need a tax exemption? Is it fair to the others playing in the market economy? One of the things Brunson told us is whether they should be tax exempt or not, they just are. Since the creation of the modern federal income tax, churches have been free from paying taxes. But if you go back to the years before that, Brunson says it wasn't at all inevitable. In fact, he told us at the end of the 1860s, there was this fight between early Mormon leaders and the early version of the IRS. The government had decided the tithing Mormons were paying was taxable. And so the bureaucrat in charge of the Utah Territory, a guy named John Taggart, worked it out and sent Brigham Young a tax bill, $60,000.
Now, this was interesting in several respects. First of all, a church as an entity wasn't theoretically supposed to be taxable. And second, Brigham Young said, we don't have any income. We just have tithing revenue, essentially. But Taggart said, no, you do have income. And because, Brigham Young, you are the trustee in trust, not only does the church owe this $60,000, but you personally owe this $60,000. And Brigham Young makes several arguments for why this shouldn't be taxable to him. The first thing he says is exactly what I've said. We're a church, its revenue tithing isn't income to us. And the response is, we believe that you're making this money in two different ways. One is that you're making it through speculative investments. You're investing in railroads, you're investing in canals, you're investing in other things. And this speculative return, the government said, doesn't seem like the thing that a church would be doing. Therefore, we think that this is income. Moreover, we think that tithing is also income to you. Tithing is income because it is, in your words, an account that runs with people throughout their lives. You keep an account of the tithing that people owe. Now, Brigham Young, again, disagrees with this assessment that tithing is mandatory. He says, we don't punish people. We're not going to excommunicate them. We're not going to, go out and kill them. And the response is, your own rhetoric says differently. Your own rhetoric says that if you don't pay your tithing, you'll be cut off. And yeah, you've never killed anyone for it, but being cut off here in the deserts of Utah away from everyone else, that's essentially a death sentence. So this is a mandatory payment that people have to make. Because it's a mandatory payment, we think that it looks more like income. And the government continues to disagree. They continue to say, you owe taxes. And in the very beginning of the new year, Brigham Young writes a letter to Daniel Wells, his counselor, and I believe the mayor of Salt Lake at the time. And he says, prepare a telegram to all of the bishops. Tell the bishops we're going to put an end to tithing. I'm not sure how we're going to raise revenue, but if tithing is taxable, we're going to end tithing. Tithing won't happen anymore. And Wells writes this up and sends it out. And at that point, we've got this weird thing where tithing, something that's mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, something that in the church's Doctrine and Covenants, it says will be a permanent law forever to the members of the church, tithing is going to be over. And at this point, it's very clear that A, the government thinks they can tax churches. B, that it thinks that the types of revenue that the LDS church has is taxable income. And C, the church really doesn't have means to pay this going forward. And the church is going to end this and try to collect revenue in some other way. And then essentially Deus Ex Machina happens. The Commissioner of Internal Revenue is fired, and a new guy named Pleasanton comes in. It turns out that Commissioner Pleasanton is not a fan of the income tax. He looks at an appeal from Brigham Young and he says, yeah, I disagree with my predecessor. I think that the Mormon Church doesn't owe taxes. And with that shift in personnel, all of a sudden, the church and Brigham Young don't owe income taxes. The church keeps its tithing. It ends up not taking that giant step that it thought it might take. And so since the end of the 1860s, beginning of the 1870s, the church hasn't in any substantive way had to worry about federal income taxes in the United States. I suspect that most current leaders aren't familiar with this story, but I also suspect that this was a big enough deal that it became an undercurrent in the church, that it became something that the church built on.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll come back to Sam Brunson here in a moment, but we're going to begin with the argument for why churches, or certain churches, shouldn't be exempt from paying taxes. A few years ago, Chad Pomeroy wrote an article making the case. He's a law professor at St. Mary's University School of Law. And Pomeroy said the tax exemption does damage to the broader economy, it discourages churches from being transparent, and he says the exemption has come to actually encourage churches away from charitable work toward more profit-seeking. Pomeroy says the LDS Church and others like it aren't just churches.
I think it's apparent if you look at the information that has been released, to the extent it's been released, that they don't only fill the role of what we have traditionally viewed as a church's role. They don't only tend to the needy, to the widows and the orphans, which is a phrase I'll probably come back to a number of times here. They are significant participants in a capitalist market economy.
I think you describe it this way in your writing, that there are two things. They're profit and spirit. Do you think the profit part has come to overshadow in a lot of cases, the spirit part?
I think it has. And, you know, there's a danger for someone like me who has a background in the LDS Church to focus on the LDS Church. But it is really a good example of a situation where I think probably most people, to the extent they're exposed to the finances of the LDS Church, are exposed to it in the context of their market participation, of their real estate holdings, of their business holdings, of a whole variety of economic activities that don't really revolve around charity and service. And that's not to say they don't engage in any of that, but I think if you look at what we know about their activities, their non-charity financial activities greatly exceed their charity-based financial activities.
The history of all of this is interesting. Why did governments give churches a tax exemption in the first place? What do we need to know about that part of the story?
The idea is pretty straightforward, right? If you think of the government's role as tending to society, and particularly to people who have needs that aren't being met in other ways, either through their own means or through friends and family, if the government's role is to tend to those people, then in a lot of ways, it makes sense for the government to get out of the way of other organizations that are already doing that. So if you have a church that is tending to widows and orphans, why would you tax them, reduce their ability to do that, and take that tax and just do that very thing? So from that perspective, in sort of a simplistic way, but I think a historically accurate way, that's how we got there. The government views taxation as the route through which it gains the money necessary to care for people in society. And if a church or some other organization, but a church in particular, if a church is doing that, why take the funds away from it? Just get out of the way and let it do that.
So the question now is, the government has said, we'll give you this tax-exempt status to do good. Like, the question is now, are they not are they doing good, but is it that are you doing enough good to justify the exemption?
You know, I think you'd have to be pretty narrow-minded to say, well, churches don't do good, and so they shouldn't get a tax exemption. That's not, I don't think, anybody's real argument or view. I mean, clearly, a lot of churches do good. Clearly, the LDS Church gives a lot to charity. So I don't think it's about, you know, yes or no, do they engage in charity? The real question is, do they do it in a way that justifies the amount of public investment in those organizations? Because if you think of a tax exemption in its economic terms, you know, if the government is saying to a church, we're not going to take X number of billion dollars mm-hmm. from you, you know, you keep those $10 billion because you're going to do what we think ought to be done with that money. And then the church turns around and only dedicates $2 billion of that $10 billion to what is presumably the basis for the government mm-hmm. not taking that money, then yeah, I think you've got a problem where, again, it's not that it hasn't done $2 billion worth of good, it's just that it cost the government $10 billion to get that $2 billion worth of good done.
There are years and years of really arcane tax law evolution, but I guess I wanted to talk about sort of the what it all adds up to, because I think one of your arguments is that we've created this system that allows a church not to be accountable for the exemption, for the money that it spends or doesn't spend on charity. It's a system, you say, that is set up for systemic abuse. So how did we don't have to go through all of the sort of particular points, but what is the system that we ended up with? How did we end up here, I guess?
I like that word accountability, because I really think that a lot of what I am critical about in the context of church taxation comes back to this idea of accountability. So from the very beginning, there has been a real hesitancy on the part of the government to get involved in churches' affairs. And I think a lot of people, including myself, candidly, would generally say, well, that's good. You know, let's not have meddling with people's affairs. To the greatest extent possible, the government should let people do what it wants. But I think it's a little bit of a different issue when you talk about a government treating different organizations differently. So if you're going to say, well, we don't want to get involved in anyone's affairs and you know, live and let live, that's one thing. But if you say, well, we want to be generally involved, we want to have a general system of taxation, we think that everybody ought to contribute except for this one group over there.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're not really going to assess the extent to which people are being faithful to the underlying purpose for which we're exempting that group. Mm. Then I think it's a real problem, because there's no accountability. And this is just laced throughout this whole area. The government and the IRS is loath to second guess whether or not someone qualifies as a church. If you tell the IRS you're a church, they really don't want to dig into your affairs. And
Professor,
you,
can I underscore that point here?
Sure.
Because I don't want to just zoom past it without emphasizing it. There is no comprehensive legal definition of church in the tax code. Is that right?
That's correct. Which is pretty amazing when you think about the extent to which churches are exempt from taxation.
How much does the policy of tax exemption for churches, how much does that actually cost taxpayers?
So that is a great question, and really much of my criticism comes from the fact that I can't tell you that, and no one else can either. And this ties back to the accountability word that you mentioned earlier. So not only is there not really accountability in terms of what qualifies as a church, but once you make that qualification, you sort of gain access to this tax exemption world. And when I say tax exemption world, in the context of a church, it means you don't even have to say what you're not paying on. So most charitable organizations have to disclose to some extent their affairs. And so they say, well, you know, we're not paying X amount of taxes on X amount of charitable contributions or X amount of income, but we can show you what we've gotten in and we can show you what we've expended on charity. But if you're a church, you don't even have to do that.
So then there's the question of If the government is saying, look, we'll give you a tax exemption because you're doing part of our job, taking care of the needy, the question of how much is enough, you know, to justify that, how much is enough? Let's take the example that you've written about. The LDS Church gave about $1.3 billion in humanitarian aid between 1985 and 2010. So what you do is you compare that to the amount of money it raised during that time, and it's less than 2%.
Yep.
So talk a little bit about that. Less than – we don't have a legal amount here, so – what's less than 2%? What do you say?
Well, I'm not even so strict or high-handed that I want to say what is or isn't good enough. 2%, 5%, 50%. I mean, you know, I don't know what percentage needs to go towards charity for the relevant organization to properly enjoy a tax exemption. But I do think that we, the people, through our governmental representatives, I do think that the government ought to be able to say that. I mean, you know, is 2% perfectly fine given the kind of overhead we'd expect? Or is it really as sort of stunningly low as it seems maybe to me? I don't know, but it seems like we ought to at least be able to have that conversation given the governmental investment that's being made.
Another thing you've been writing about is that the system, the way this system has been constructed, it actually amounts to discouraging churches from pursuing their charitable goals.
So if you've got a situation where churches are not accountable because there's no transparency, they don't have to tell people what they're doing with their money. And over here, you have a situation where they're able to invest these non-taxed funds and generate returns that are systemically different. You know, the returns they demand are systemically different from the returns other people demand. I think you almost have a situation where you'd almost be foolish not to take those dollars and invest them. You know, you've got low cost of capital money and you've got lots of market opportunities. You're able to get quick and easy access to those opportunities because you don't have to drive the hard bargain that other market participants have to. How could you take that $10 billion and not invest it, you know, in real estate development in Florida? Why would you ever take that $10 billion and give it to poor people who can't eat in other parts of the world? It's almost like the economic incentives that arise from the confluence of lack of transparency and lack of taxation ineluctably lead you to want to invest in the market.
Hmm. You write about some ways, some suggestions you have to solve the problem here. And I wanted to ask you about some of these. One of them is, of course, increased transparency. So let's talk a little bit about that. One of the things you say is let's require churches to file a Form 990. So I don't want people's eyes glazing over because we're talking about an IRS form, but do explain what this is and how this is relevant. I guess they don't have to file the form now. So explain this part because this gets at the transparency argument you make.
Yeah, so a Form 990 is just – it's a return of organization exempt from income tax, and it lays out a tax exempts organization's gross income, receipts, and disbursements. Yeah. So the idea is if you're tax exempt, that's fine. You don't owe us taxes, but tell us how much money you had coming in. Tell us how much you spent, you know, essentially on overhead.
Yeah.
And tell us how much you spent on charity. It's a real basic form. I mean, I personally help run our little neighborhood swim team down here, and we're a 501c3 tax exempt organization, and I fill out the real quick and easy Form 990 every year for it, and it takes me like 2 minutes. It's very, very easy because of how small we are. But essentially, it's just this idea, tell us what you had coming in, tell us what you had going out, and we can assess whether or not it's adequately charitable. And as you know, churches just don't have to do that. It just goes out the window entirely when it comes to a church.
How would the world be different if we changed this? We took away the tax-exempt status of churches and we made them file a 990 and be more accountable for the money they're actually spending on charity. If you took away tax-exempt status, would it keep some members from paying tithing or giving donations? Would it change the relationship between leaders and their members? I mean, I don't know. Are you imagining a world that would be different from one today?
I like to think that it would not change the level of contribution that members are making. Again, going back to what I said, I have a hard time in my mind picturing anybody who's making a contribution to the LDS Church or any other church and doesn't care whether or not it goes to good purposes. I think that, though, that there are maybe some people who hold back making those contributions, particularly in light of some of the things that have come out over the last 10 to 15 years. Maybe there's some people who hold back, but if they had a higher degree of confidence that their funds were being properly used, they would make contributions. So I don't think it would reduce the level of charitable giving. I think it would increase it, at least in terms of the giving to the organization. Now, on the other side, I think it actually would have pretty significant consequences. I definitely think you'd see organizations like the LDS Church invest a whole heck of a lot less money in private endeavors. I don't think you'd see the LDS Church, you know, buying 2% of Florida or whatever it was. I mean, that to me is almost impossible to imagine in a world where everybody follows how much comes in and how much actually goes out to charity. Maybe I'm being naive, but I think that the level of embarrassment there would just would really have an effect on the extent to which, you know, some of these churches engage in profit-seeking behavior.
Chad Pomeroy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Chad Pomeroy, he is a professor of law at St. Mary's University School of Law. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we're asking, why shouldn't a church pay taxes? If you're like the Catholic Church or the LDS Church and you have hundreds of billions in investments and real estate holdings, do you really need a tax exemption? We've been talking about the principles of accountability and asking how much spending on charity is enough to justify the exemption. Let's get back to Sam Brunson. He's a law professor at Loyola University of Chicago and an expert on tax law. He's also a practicing Latter-day Saint. And Brunson told us this concern people have about the conflict between making money and doing good isn't limited to churches alone.
Last week, Elon Musk filed a lawsuit against OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT.
Yeah.
OpenAI is a nonprofit and a tax-exempt organization, and part of Elon Musk's complaint is that it has started pursuing profit. It has too much money, and it's too focused on making money. We see those complaints with the LDS Church. We see them with nonprofit hospitals, and it's a weird thing because we have this word nonprofit, and when we think nonprofit, we think it isn't working to make money. It doesn't need to have money. It doesn't want to focus on money.
Yeah.
It's got some other higher thing that it looks for. And it turns out that from a legal perspective, nonprofit's a technical term. And nonprofit means that it doesn't share its profits. A for-profit organization can make a bunch of money and then can distribute it to shareholders. A nonprofit can also make a lot of money, but it has to reinvest that money in its charitable mission. It can't give that money to people. People can't make a profit off of it. And the goal with that is, again, that it not pursue just profit motives, that it pursue something higher than profits. And the thought process behind it is, if individuals aren't going to share in the profits, if we don't have shareholders demanding consistent returns, then it can focus on other things. So I think a big part of this story is a general discomfort with nonprofits making money. And then on top of that, we add to it this idea of Christianity, where in the Bible, we see Jesus eschewing the idea of wealth and money. We have the story of him overturning the tables in the court of the temple. Once he dies, we have the apostolic church where everyone donates to the church and the church takes care of everyone. So there's this discomfort with nonprofits having money on top of a Christian discomfort with money. And on top of that, we have vast, vast sums of money. I don't know if it's $50 billion or $100 billion or $150 billion or $250 billion or approaching $1 trillion. Frankly, any one of those numbers, anywhere between $40 billion and $1 trillion, the difference is meaningless to me. Those are just huge sums of money. That money can transform into power. It can transform into things that we're uncomfortable with. So I think a lot of this story is kind of this inherent and understandable discomfort with the idea of a church having this much money, these many assets, this much power.
Let me come back to the idea that, as you say, a church can be nonprofit, but it doesn't mean it can't make money. They're allowed to make profits under certain conditions. And let's set aside the religious part for a minute, and let's use the example of a nonprofit hospital. In the same way, a nonprofit hospital can make profits, but it just has to do this very specific thing with those profits. It can't distribute the money to shareholders. It has to reinvest that money in what it does. Now, that makes more sense with a hospital, but how does that apply to a church? How do you reinvest that money in a church?
I say reinvest. I'm not sure if that's the perfect word for it. But for a church to reinvest that money in the church mission, there are all sorts of things it can do. It can basically use that money to do anything that the church is pursuing. So it can use that money to build buildings. It can use that money to pay salaries. It can use that money to distribute humanitarian aid. It can use that money to print and proselyte religious stuff. It can use that money basically for any legal purpose within its realm.
But does it have to use that money? That is it okay, seems like it is, for it to just sit there and exponentially grow by the hundreds and hundreds of millions?
From a legal perspective, almost definitely. It has to eventually use that money for some sort of religious charitable purpose. But for what are called public charities, and churches and hospitals are public charities. Public charities are basically operating charities as opposed to private foundations, which are places that wealthy people put money and then eventually the private foundation distributes it to operating charities. So for public charities, the law doesn't have any distribution requirement. The law doesn't require them at any specific point to use that money. At some point, theoretically, at least, the money will be used or the charity will cease to operate. So it doesn't technically ever have to spend the money, but the money has to stay in what we call charitable solution. The money can't go out from the charity to be used for something that isn't charitable.
What do you make of the argument that when you have a church that uses its tax-exempt funds to play the market, to build a stock portfolio, to buy real estate, that it's doing that at the disadvantage of other entities that do have to pay taxes, and that it does damage to the broader market economy? Do you think that's right?
So there's something in the tax law called the unrelated business income tax. And the unrelated business income tax says that if you're a tax-exempt organization and you're competing in a business that's not related to your fundamental charitable mission, then you have to pay taxes on that income like any other taxpayer. And this is something where actually the Mormon Church does what most nonprofits that have active businesses do, which is it sticks them in a subsidiary taxable corporation. So it's for-profit orchards and ranches are in for-profit corporations. When they earn money, they pay taxes at a 21% corporate tax rate, and then they can distribute the rest of it to the Mormon Church. So as long as we're talking about those active businesses, it doesn't end up being unfair competition with taxable people because they're paying the same amount of tax.
So your investment arm, in the case of the LDS Church, the Ensign Peak Advisors, that's not seen as the same as the institution itself. That's a taxable entity. So when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions, possibly a quarter of a trillion dollars in assets, a good bit of that money is being taxed, is what you're saying, is not tax exempt.
So some portion of it is. The stuff in Ensign Peak Advisors isn't, because there's a second level to this, which is passive investments. That is, stocks, bonds, those kinds of things aren't unrelated business taxable income. So the church isn't going to be taxable on its investment in GameStop and its investment in GE and whatever else it has in Ensign Peak Advisors. With that, I think we have less concern because the publicly traded stock market is considered a liquid market. Mm. Now, it may be unfair if the church is holding $40 billion of securities in that area. That is probably going to at least marginally drive up the price, although I'd have to look at the total market capitalization of everything to see how much the $40 billion. And I say $40 billion because that's roughly what Ensign Peak Advisors says they have in reportable securities to the SEC. Mm. So the church isn't going to be taxable on that side of things. Should it be? I think that is an open question. It's a policy decision that Congress has made and reiterated that tax-exempt organizations aren't going to be taxable. So where the church is actually engaged in a business, we think of engaged in the business as you're actually ranching or you're actually operating radio stations. My understanding is Bonneville has radio and television stations. To the extent those are operated for profit, it's going to pay taxes on those things.
How much money would go into the system if you stripped away a church's tax exemption? Do we have any sense of that? I'm not just talking about the LDS church's tax exemption. I think you've made this argument that it actually wouldn't bring that much money. Is that right?
Overall, it wouldn't bring in a lot of revenue from an income tax perspective because most churches, frankly, aren't terribly profitable. Right now, if you're tax exempt, there are a couple benefits. One is you don't pay taxes, but most donations to churches aren't going to qualify as taxable income. They're going to qualify as gifts, notwithstanding what the federal government said in the 1860s, 1870s to the Mormon church. If I pay my tithing, I'm not getting something back from that. That's considered a gift. The IRS and the Supreme Court have both said stuff like pew rents or for paying to go to the high holidays at Jewish congregations aren't actually exchanges of property, and therefore they're charitable, they're gifts, they're contributions. So any income that a church receives through contributions isn't going to be taxable, whether or not the church is tax exempt. So I think it would be hard to quantify. Ultimately, there probably would be some additional revenue to the U.S. government, but I don't think it would be substantial. I don't think as a percentage of federal revenue, it would make a huge difference.
David Nielsen, as you know, who's the former fund manager with the Ensign Peak Advisors, has accused the church of using deception to, as he put it, masquerade as tax exempt, and that Ensign Peak has improperly reaped billions in untaxed income that should have been taxed. Is he wrong?
I think that he's wrong. And most of the tax people I've talked to on reflection, on careful study, think that he's wrong. And I will say being wrong doesn't make him bad. This is a complicated area of law. It's something that my colleagues and I actually spent a fair amount of time looking for. But it looks like under the tax law, an investment arm of a church does qualify as tax exempt. And if it qualifies as tax exempt, it's not inappropriate. If it were inappropriate, on top of that, I would say if the church didn't have an outside organization, it could just bring all of its investments in-house, invest in-house, and that would be absolutely tax exempt returns on the investments. So it's not 100% easy to get to that conclusion, but ultimately I think that he misunderstands the way the tax law works.
It's interesting. This is one of those stories where you have such kind of subjective impressions that people have about this story. It's, you know, it's colored by their experience or their bias, and naturally so. But Is there an objective measure of just how much a church should give to charity to make it legal, but also to be considered enough, you know, generous? I mean, the LDS Church gives nearly $1 billion a year. This was in, I think the last numbers I saw were 2021, right. Nearly $1 billion. And some say, look, that's a fraction, a teeny fraction of what it could be giving. So how do you discuss and talk about something that seems so subjective? Is there an objective measure, or maybe even a legal objective measure of saying, here's how much you have to give proportional to how much you have?
So there's not currently a legal objective measure. I mentioned private foundations earlier, and the tax law says that a private foundation needs to distribute or otherwise spend about 5% of its assets a year. And that 5% number isn't huge, but ensures that they pay something. But like I said, for an operating charity, for a public charity like the church, like a hospital, like the opera, there isn't that same requirement. So objectively, there really isn't a requirement. But subjectively, I think that this actually makes some demand on charities. And the demand that the church is hearing incidentally from members is part of that. It may be, for all I know, that the church is spending exactly the appropriate amount. I feel like probably it could spend more, but it might be spending the right amount. But what it really would be helpful for the church to do would be to explain how it's decided how much it wants in reserves, how it's decided how much to spend, and maybe how it decides when and where to spend that. Mm-hmm. So I can't say objectively that there is a right answer, but I can say that subjectively, this is the kind of thing that a charity generally actually, if it wants to continue getting donations, does need to have some transparency with its donors with. The LDS Church is in a slightly different position because the donations, for many members, it feels like the religious obligation to give an allegedly objective amount. So I think that the answer to that is hard. I personally subjectively think that the church should be spending down a higher percentage of its assets. I could be convinced otherwise, but it would require some convincing.
Sam Brunson, he's a law professor at Loyola University of Chicago. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. What would it take to do this, to get rid of, for, let's say, large institutions that have, let's say, that make $100 million in earnings or so, that they have to pay taxes at this point? Let's say that's the – could you do that legally? I mean, one of the things you've talked about is you could, but you couldn't just say, all right, we're going to target the LDS Church. You have to do this more broadly. The Supreme Court or the rules in play here say you can't just be selective, I guess.
Right. So in fact, Congress in 2017 did something along those lines. It said for universities with endowments of, I believe it's $500,000 or more per full-time student, they owe an excise tax on their endowment. So you could absolutely do something like that if you wanted. But if you said, we want all churches with an endowment of $500,000 per member, or, you know, we want to aim it at the Mormon Church and the Roman Catholic Church, or something more specific like that. If it's clear that you're aiming just at churches, that would almost definitely violate the First Amendment's protections on religion. You can aim something toward universities. You could do it toward hospitals, just standing alone, because there is no First Amendment protection for medical practice or something like that. So if it wanted to do that, I think that there would be no constitutional issue with saying, we're going to impose a 5% excise tax on any charitable organization with over $100 million in assets or whatever number they decided on. But if they say for every church with over $100 million in assets, that's going to be harder. If they say for every tax-exempt organization with more than $250 billion in assets, and it turns out that the Mormon Church is the only one like that, and Congress knows that, again, you can't get around it by not saying that you're doing it explicitly, but actually doing it explicitly. So there's no instant magical way to do it, but I think you could absolutely impose a tax on charitable organizations, tax-exempt organizations with some quantum of assets.
What would change if you made churches tax-exempt? What would happen, do you think? Now, I understand what would happen to a small church that really relies on donations from its members and that kind of incentive that comes from a tax deduction on that contribution. But what would change for the Catholic Church? What would change for the LDS Church, do you think, if they no longer had that tax exemption?
And so there are probably two main things. One is, charitable donations are what economists call elastic. The more expensive they are, the less people donate. Hmm. And all of the studies are generally charitable donations, not religious donations in particular. Again, religious donations may be less elastic. The raising cost may not change them much. But presumably donations would fall by some amount, even if not substantially. The second thing is that the churches would probably rearrange to some extent the way they do things, in the same way that Brigham Young decided to rearrange and eliminate tithing. If you said we're going to tax all entities, all charities, all tax-exempt organizations with more than $100 billion in assets, the church could divide into separate entities. Mm. One reason that we see the Mormon Church as having so many assets as compared to, say, the Roman Catholic Church is the Roman Catholic Church organizes separate corporations. I think it's at the diocese level. Mm. So it's not the Vatican that owns all of the Catholic property. The Vatican owns some property, but the Diocese of Chicago owns the property here in Chicago, and the Archdiocese of San Francisco owns the property in San Francisco. I'm not 100% sure if it's the diocese level or the archdiocese level or the parish level, although I don't think it's the parish level.
No, but the point is they spread it out. And I guess what you're saying is this would be easy to dodge. You just spread it out among the different wards and stakes in the case of the LDS Church.
Yeah, you just say instead of Salt Lake owning all the property, we'll put it at the stake level or at the mission level or at the area level and incorporate separately, which is perfectly legal and frankly is what if I were the church's attorney and this happened, I'd advise. But even though the church doesn't want it, it's absolutely something that the church could do.
So I know part of your argument is that, yes, you could argue these rules need to change or should be changed. You could make that argument, but that's not what the law says right now. You know, it is what it is. But Professor, do you think the LDS Church has sort of gotten to the point where donations and tithing don't actually make a material difference on the health of the church? And they could handle paying this tax at this point.
I mean, I think that's probably right. From what I'm understanding, assuming that the numbers that I've seen are right, the church could operate probably in perpetuity, or if not in perpetuity, for a long time without collecting revenue, tithing revenue from members. Now, is that the right thing?
Yeah.
I just read Professor Stephen Taysom's biography of Joseph F. Smith, and Joseph F. Smith made a big deal out of the importance to his mother, Mary Fielding Smith, of being able to pay tithing. And as practicing Mormons, many of us believe that there are blessings associated with tithe paying. So I don't know that the church should eliminate tithing, but I think that the church should put itself in a position where it actually needs tithing to make that tithe paying more meaningful and more impactful.
Well, that that, as they say, horse has left the barn in the case of the LDS Church, right? I mean, that's just an academic question because the church has, I think you yourself have said, it's an unfathomable amount of money.
I mean, the horse has mostly left the barn, and my experience with horses is basically having ridden them three times and being thrown from one at least once. So I don't know a lot about horses.
Yeah.
But I think this is one situation where the church has the ability to put that horse partially back in the barn.
Hmm.
It would require spending down significantly from its reserves.
Yeah.
I don't know what the appropriate thing to do would be, but the church has enough money that it could fund a moonshot. It could fund research to deal with cancer or malaria or, you know, maybe not disease, but hunger or something like that. It could spend down a ton of money. It could follow the McKinsey-Scott method of not saving up her money for when she dies, but spending her money on charitable things immediately to try and improve life. If the church has $200 billion, like I said, that's unfathomable. I don't know what that is. I don't know how I could spend it, but you could do a lot of good with it, and you could do a lot of immediate good.
You have talked about wanting from the church a plan for the money they have, and that the church has a responsibility, you've said, to articulate a vision for that money. So give us a sense of what you mean. Like, what would that look like?
I think that would be an awesome conversation for the church to go to the membership and say, hey, we have a ton of money. What do you all think we should do with that? Even if it didn't particularly adopt what I think it should do or what anyone that I know think it should do. I think fundamentally with that, though, I would like to know, I would like the church to articulate what its goals are with this money. This money, because the church seems to be able to operate comfortably on its tithing revenue, it seems like this should go somewhere else. And I know the church does a lot of work with vaccination. It does a lot of work, you know, distributing wheelchairs, I believe. It's got three or four humanitarian things that it does. And so maybe it's double down on that, or maybe it's we're concerned about the next global pandemic. So we're saving up our money, but when the global pandemic comes, we're going to ask people to stop paying tithing and instead fund it through this. Or when the global pandemic comes, we're going to use this money to help distribute the drugs that are necessary to developing economies. Or we have this money and we don't know exactly what we're going to do, but we commit to using 5% of it every year to do various charitable things, even if we can't be specific yet about what that is. Mm. I would love for the church to actively think about and decide, now that we have this much money, what is it that we're going to do with this much money?
Quick last question. Do you think Americans care about churches that get these tax exemptions? I know there's a vocal group here and in other places, you know, looking at the Catholic Church, looking at the LDS Church. But in general, do you think Americans think much about this?
No. I think that most Americans are more concerned about other things. I think occasionally it rises to the level of consciousness, but I think that this kind of thing is much more salient in Utah, and to those of us who are members of the church, it's not entirely absent. I have a close friend here in Chicago who's Catholic, who periodically texts me when he sees something about the church's investments. I have friends and colleagues who are tax and nonprofit professors and attorneys, and this is very salient to them, although it's salient to them in part because journalists reach out to them to ask, why is this happening? My impression is, to the extent that people think about it, they think that churches should be doing good with their money, that they should be spending their money in ways that help make the country and the world and their communities better.
Sam Brunson, thanks very much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Sam Brunson, he's a law professor at Loyola University of Chicago. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas or comments or feedback, you can email them at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.